Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash broadcasting live, along with co-host Eb Wilkinson. We welcome you to a special Veterans Day weekend edition of Inside Track. As always, thanks so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. Talking about great local companies you should be doing business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets. Joy, Kelly, and Jennifer can help you design your dream kitchen or bath area. Corazon Cabinets carries J&K, Conestoga, and now Yorktown Cabinets. Come by and visit the showroom soon, see our great displays, and see what your home will look like with Corazon Cabinets. Business is booming, and customers just love their Corazon Cabinets. We have the very latest colors and finishes and are one of the few suppliers of Yorktown Cabinets in Southern Arizona. Call 488-2266 and let them know you heard this ad on Inside Track to receive an additional 5% discount on Corazon's already low wholesale prices. We have a great show for you today. In a minute or so, we'll talk to Karen Young with Mountain Oyster Club on their 50th anniversary Western Art Show. And she'll visit with us and tell us about the show and what's going on. Then we'll hear from Michael Reagan to share a Veterans Day message and talk about his work with the Reagan Legacy Foundation and the Walkway to Victory located in France along the Normandy beaches stormed by our Allied soldiers as they liberated France and the rest of Europe 75 years ago. During the second half of our show, retired Air Force Brigadier General and former Commandant of the Air National Guard, Don Shepard, and friend of the show and former jet fighter pilot himself, Benny White, to share their military experiences on what Veterans Day means to them. Okay, let's get to it. Karen Young is with us. She's chairman of the art committee at the Mountain Oyster Club here in Tucson. The MO Club holds a yearly art auction, which is coming up later this month that she's going to tell us about. This art show features the very best contemporary paintings and three-dimensional Western art from the best up-and-coming artists, as well as many of the finest established painters and sculptors in the genre. Welcome, Karen. How are you?
I'm very well, Bruce. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure. When is the 50th anniversary Mountain Oyster Club Western Art Show?
The sale that is open to the public takes place on Sunday, November 24th. That's the Sunday prior to Thanksgiving week. And the show begins at 3 o'clock, the sale does. It's open only to folks that have purchased a ticket to attend prior to the event. There are no tickets sold at the door. Folks come in at 3 o'clock and they have 2.5 hours to look at the art. And if there's anything that they would like to sign on, might want to purchase, they can do that. And then we have a drawing at 5:30 when the show closes to see who gets the individual pieces. So, Karen, a wonderful afternoon.
So Karen, if somebody wanted to actually get a ticket, how would they go about doing that?
The best way to do it, you can go online at the Mountain Oyster website is www.mountainoysterclub.com, and there is a art show tile that they can click on, or they can call the club. It's 520-623-3417 and request an invitation be sent to them.
So there are some major artists as well as real great up-and-comers. Talk about your favorites that you've seen so far in the art that's been selected for the show.
Well, as we, you know, the Mountain Oyster has a group of over 100 artists that they've inducted into the club as honorary artist members. And many of them participate in the show annually, and we're happy to have, because this is the 50th anniversary, so this is the 50th show that we're holding, started in early 70s. So we have many of those honorary artist members participating, and some of the ones that are I'm most familiar with are our local artists, Howard Post, Sue Crisden, we have Fred Hamley, Lawrence Lee, Michael Ewing, Richard Imes,
Some great artists.
Wonderful artists. And artists that are, as you mentioned, not only painters, but that are sculptors as well, and bronze, and we do have some folks that carve wood that are involved.
And this art is affordable. It goes from just a couple hundred dollars into the thousands, but lots of this art is very, very affordable, don't you think?
That's correct. And that's one of our objectives, is to bring in new artists every year, new artists to the show, but also up-and-coming artists, as you mentioned, that are just beginning their career and trying to sell art in the community where they live. And all of the information on the prices for the show are available on the website. The way our sale works is that the artists send us the images. It's a juried show, so that the committee juries the show. This year we looked at 1,300 pieces, and we have 350 in the show. So the artist sets the price, and then the buyer pays the artist.
I've been attending these shows, friends, for probably the last 35 years. This is a great show, and anybody who's interested in contemporary Western art, this is a rare, rare chance to see such great art all in one place. One more time, Karen, how do people find out about the show and buy a ticket?
They can either go to the website, which is www.mountainoysterclub.com, or they can call the club at 520-623-3417. And the purchase price for a ticket is $50, and that includes your entry into the club. And there are refreshments and wonderful hors d'oeuvres, and it's an incredibly festive environment. So,
and friends, there'll be some mountain oysters there for you as well. They're very, very tasty. Karen, thanks very much for coming on the show. We'll look forward to hearing how the show went after everything happens. But friends, go out there and take a look at it. Look, don't go anywhere. We have a great show for you this afternoon. Stay tuned Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. This is Bruce and Ebba's across the table. Our guests for the rest of this Veterans Day weekend show are retired Brigadier, Air Force Brigadier General Don Shepard, and many time Inside Track guest with us. Thanks, Don, for appearing. And old friend Benny White, who is well known to all of our local listeners, both veterans and here to talk about their great careers. And, you know, I don't know if I've ever asked you both. You've both had great careers in the military. How'd you both decide to serve? What was the thing that got you, Don?
Yeah, it was real simple for me. I was a senior in high school. In those days, they didn't have all kinds of advisors and catalogs and people advising you and stuff like that. So the fall of my senior year in high school, my dad says, "So what are you thinking about college?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to go to the University of Colorado Medical School." He says, "Really? How are you going to pay for it?" I said, So I started looking for a free education. I went to my barber, and he says, "I was in the Navy in World War II. He said, "I think the Navy's got a college, something like a Naval Academy or something. You ought to check into it." So I came home, checked into it. Pretty soon I had an appointment to the Naval Academy. And I went downtown shopping at Christmas, rode a bus downtown, and there were three Air Force Academy cadets there. I said, "Well, this is a message from God. I belong in the Air Force, not in the Navy." So I applied for the Air Force Academy and got in there. So I ended up there at 17 years old. I started a long career.
Wow.
And by the way, you can call me anything you want, but don't reduce my paycheck. I was a major general, not a brigadier general.
I am so sorry. first error of what I hope won't be very many more. But thank you, General. I appreciate that. And Benny, how about you? How'd you manage to get into the service? And you know, what was the start of your career?
Well, I was in University of Oklahoma in the 1967 time frame, and that was my senior year. And I ran out of money to pay my bills and do a lot of other things, and so I started looking around at what I was going to do in the rest of my life. I went downtown and talked to the recruiters. My dad was in the Navy in World War II, and so I said, "Well, I'll go talk to the Navy guys and see what they've got for people that have had some college education but not a degree." So I walked into the Navy recruiter, and we sat there and talked for a while, and he said, "Well," he said, "boy, you sound really good, but I can't help you because you don't have that four-year degree, but those Marines down the hall, you go down there and talk to them, see what they might have for you." So I went down there and I talked to, I think it was a gunnery sergeant, and we talked for about 20, 30 minutes. By the time I got through with it, I was going to be a squadron commander in about 6 months and fly fighters all kinds of places across the world. And so they signed me up for a program at that time called the MARCAD program. And the way that worked was you enlisted in the Marine Corps and went to enlisted boot camp. And once you completed the boot camp, you went to Pensacola as a sergeant and went to flight school as a sergeant. And then eventually when you completed flight school, you became a commissioned officer and off you went. About my third week in boot camp, there was an announcement over the phone that says, by the way, the MARCAD program has been terminated. So I went up to my platoon commander, who was a captain, and I said, sir, what does this mean? He says, Private White, that means you're in the Marine Corps. Welcome aboard. So I was an enlisted Marine for about a year and a half. Got picked up to go to officer school. Got picked
up. So you kind of had a kind of a circular, surreptitious.
That's been my life history.
Yeah. Oh, how interesting.
And eventually I went to the basic school at Marine Corps Quantico. Finished that, got selected to go to flight school, went to Air Force flight school because the Navy system couldn't train all of the Air Force pilots or the Marine pilots at that time.
And what year was all this happening?
I went in the Marine Corps in August of 67. I went to a flight school at Valdosta, Georgia with George Bush. We began in November of 68, I'm sorry. Graduated in November of 69, and then I did a little work up at Cherry Point, North Carolina, Beaufort, South Carolina, and then went to Da Nang and was in Da Nang for a year.
So you never made it to Pensacola?
Never did, other than when I got back, they assigned me to be a training command instructor, and I went down to Pensacola and taken some students down there to do aircraft qualifications, but never as a student.
And Don, how about you? What about year was it that you got into the academy and started your career?
I graduated from the
high school. I'm not trying to date you.
No. I tried. Well, I never wanted to be this old till just recently, so things are looking good. I graduated from high school in 1958 and went in that summer, 17 years old, into the academy, starting my career. But my interest in aviation came in a different way.
How's that?
I grew up during World War II and lived with my grandparents in San Antonio. My dad was a civil service worker out at Randolph modifying airplanes during the war. So we were out to a bond drive during the war, you know, where they're raising funds. And at the end of the air show there, my dad says, you want to ride in an airplane? The instructors at that time were allowed to keep their airplanes on the side of the ramp there and what have you. So I said, oh, yeah, I really would. And so we go over this little shack on the side of the airplane, and there's loud music and smoke coming out of there, and somebody yells in, hey, Bob, somebody wants to ride in your airplane. Bob comes out, and he's got a bottle of beer in one hand, his arm around a beautiful blonde woman the other right there. I said, aviation is the life for me.
And that's the Air Force.
There you go.
And have you had a little bit, I know you don't like talking about yourself, but you had a little bit of a career in aviation yourself in the service.
Yeah, well, I started off in artillery. I actually was selected for flight school, went down to Pensacola. They looked at my eyes, said, you're 20/25, so you're legally blind. And I ended up going to Fort Sill for artillery school, did some time at 29 Palms. This is during the biggest peacetime operation that existed, so it's right in the 80s. So because of me, the world was at peace for that period of time. Went down, got selected to go to Aerial Observer School at New River, and ended up on OV-10 Broncos at VMO-2 for a few years. Oh.
So, fellas, describe your training when you actually went to flight school and so on. How would it compare to a young Air Force or Marine pilot today? What was different about your training than maybe what it is today?
Well, when I went there, I had not flown before. I wanted to fly civilian airplanes, and we just didn't have the money growing up for me to do that, and so didn't live close enough where I could be a line boy or anything of that sort. So when my first flight was in a T-37 aircraft at Williams Air Force Base here in Arizona, and basically I went into the second class of T-38s that were in the Air Force. Many years later, my son, who was a Naval Academy graduate, then took his commission in the Air Force, went to pilot training with the Air Force, and he flew some of the T-38s that I flew when I graduated from the Academy. So I was in the second class and started out flying, and it was just like anything else. All strange to me, wonderful. A lot of guys got sick in the airplanes. You know, you don't know how you're going to react to you getting an airplane. I never got sick at all. I loved it from the very first and did fine. And then your class standing depended upon where you went. You got to choose your assignment best on class standing. So I got to go in the F-100, start in the F-100 across the town at Luke. So it was all nothing but a joy for me. Jets all along. The old days, guys used to fly in tail draggers and cloth airplanes, stuff like that. All jets for me because I started in 1962 in pilot training.
And the F-100 was a pretty hot airplane.
It's a great, great airplane. It was hot for the time. Now it's really old, and so am I.
it's still a cool-looking airplane, though.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Yeah. And Benny, for you, how different do you perceive flight training for you versus what happens today if say, one of your kids was going into the air service of one sort or another?
Well, I'd pack them up on the back and say good luck. I think it's a great lifestyle. I had the experience of having both the Air Force system first, and then the Navy system later as an instructor for 4 years. And they're quite different, different attitude and different philosophy. The Air Force flight school was great about teaching people how to fly in instrument conditions and be very precise with control of the airplane. The Navy system focused more on individuality, whereas the Air Force was, you were always going to be a part of a team. You were going to be a wingman for a long time, and then maybe you'd wind up being a flight lead, and then eventually you'd move on up into the command structure. The Navy philosophy was that you were going to be a single-seat fighter pilot, and you were going to go aboard an aircraft carrier in bad weather. And so we really emphasized a lot of individuality and individual decision-making in the Navy system as compared to what I had experienced in the Air Force system. I really can't talk about what they're doing today. I know we've gone through a long period of time where a lot of people that came out of the various academies and thought they were going to go to flight school didn't have an airplane to go to. I think those days are over, and a lot of people are going to flight school now. I just went to a Marine reunion last year and went into the mess hall there at the basic school, and a bunch of young second lieutenants sitting there, and I asked, any of you guys going to flight school? And 87 of them held their hands up. I couldn't believe it. In my flight school class, there were 3 of us that got to go to flight school. So things have changed dramatically. People are coming out of flight school or coming out of their initial officer training now. When they get orders to go to flight school, they actually wind up flying an airplane if they'd like to do that.
So
there is a big difference these days that's being tried. It's called the New Air Force Pilot Training. I'm not sure that's the exact name of it. But basically what the kids do is they start out not flying airplanes like we did, but they start out with virtual reality goggles. And they go through about 3 months of training with and they do all sorts of things that we used to do, takeoffs, landings, formation, instrument flying with these virtual reality goggles. And then they get some airplane time, and then they get some more airplane time. But they end up finishing pilot training with about half the amount of actual flying time we used to have. Those kids are now just entering the system. I was just out at Eglin Air Force Base, F-35 training. They're just about to get their first kids that have been through the new pilot training with half the time they had, but lots of other types of new training. So they want to see how it works. If it works, it's going to be, you can produce pilots faster and much less cost.
So the airplanes today are far more complex than the aircraft you flew, in terms of the avionics and all the electronics and the types of weapons that they carry. With such a low number of hours compared to what it used to be, what kind of pilots are these pilots going to be, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you this. The kids these days are much smarter, much more aware than we are, much more into the modern world of computers and stuff like that. They know things that we don't know at all. And so the new airplanes that are electronic and computer controlled and what have you, they're really into that stuff. So I don't think they're going to have a problem with that part. The real problem comes into how much does flying time itself really count? In other words, there's a certain amount of things that you can do on goggles, but you don't feel the G's, you don't feel your heart palpitation and stuff like that, like you do when you get yourself in serious situations flying. So I don't think we know. But I think there's great hopes that we can do things smarter and faster. Now, remember, the airlines now, when you take a flight with a new airline captain or a new airline pilot, he has not flown an airplane there before. That's his first flight. He flies it with an instructor in the cockpit. Everything else is in the simulator with airlines. They don't have training flights anymore at all. So this is a whole new world, and these kids are much more adept at it than Benny and I were as we entered pilot training. Hmm.
I guess I would agree with most of that. My concern, my son is a research scientist that works on various classified DOD projects, and part of that is building autonomous airplanes that don't have a pilot in them. And one of the discussions that we have over time is the decision-making process that goes into being involved in combat and making decisions about employment of weapons and those kind of things. A lot of that is now being computerized, and the pilot's role is to just consent to the launch of a missile. So some of that decision-making has been output, but there are a lot of things that happen in a combat environment for situational awareness about where the good guys and where the bad guys are, what are the priorities at the moment, all those kind of things that come through experience of being there and doing that. And those are the kinds of things that I'm concerned that as we go to automated systems with no pilots involved in the airplanes, that we're probably going to have to go through some learning lessons there.
So the Air Force is talking about the new, I think it's the B-21, yep. A $500 million airplane. They want, I think, about $1 trillion almost to make 180 of them. The Chinese have really upgraded their equipment and their capabilities. Are we still looking at a manned aircraft, Air Force and Marine Corps and Navy, or are we going to be maybe a pilotless sort of an Air Force as time goes on?
Well, it's very clear that the Air Force is going to change, and that the unmanned systems, unmanned, what they call unmanned combat aerial vehicles, UCAVs, and drones play a bigger part in everything we're going to be doing. And there's a lot of things that I did in Vietnam that I sure wish a drone had been there at the time to do them rather than me. It's a new world out there, and none of us yet know what the B-21 is going to be and how many are going to be manned and unmanned. But you can be sure that they're talking about things such as standoff weapons, standoff drones, swarms of drones, and things of that sort. All the things that you see on TV and in the movies are likely going to be part of the future out there, but it's not been defined. We're moving into the B-21 from a bomber standpoint, and as you say, they want 180, and they're going to cost a lot of money. We don't know how many we're going to end up with. We wanted, I think it was 100 B-2s, and we ended up with 27 at
right.
B-2s. So you don't know what you're going to end up with. We're also going to we're also starting into the sixth generation world of fighters beyond the F-35 and the F-22. We don't know what that's going to look like and how many of them are going to be unmanned. But I'll be willing to bet that there are going to be a lot of unmanned systems that we don't contemplate right now.
I think that's true. There'll be a mix of manned commanders and unmanned loyal wingmen.
But Benny, I don't see how the unmanned's going to be able to replace the close air support that the Navy and Marine Corps really give?
Well, there will be situations where that'll be a challenge, and that's the things that people like my son are involved in right now. How do we design and build systems that are going to be flexible enough and responsive enough that we can make sure that they get the job done and don't hurt people that we're trying to protect? So those are real issues to be dealt with.
Now, let me say something about close air support, which Benny and I did a lot of in Vietnam. The soldiers really like close air support because they can see it, they can feel it, they can hear it. It scares the enemy and what have you.
Yes.
But the key to close air support is applying weapons on things that need to be hit while the enemy is attacking. A smart thing to do is not to have airplanes down low where they can get shot down in the threat environment, but to be from standoff and far away. We can now have weapons that do that. Our problem in Vietnam and stuff like that was we really couldn't find what we're after a lot of times, and we found that we really couldn't hit it because we didn't have precision standoff weapons. We didn't have targeting pods. We didn't have ECM, chaff, flare. We didn't have real nighttime capability like we do now. So our ability to stand off and do things, including close air support with new weapons, is much better than it was. So I'm hoping that our airplane losses will go down and our effectiveness with close air support weapons will go up.
Fellas, let's go ahead. Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back after hearing some messages from our sponsors. You're listening to Inside Track. We're here with Major General Don Shepherd and with friend of the show, former, what was your final rank?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Lieutenant Colonel Benny White in the Marine Division. I blew that. Marine Air Service, right? Or have I got that wrong, too?
That works.
Marine Aviation.
Okay. Or the Air National Guard, either one. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, you listen to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce Ash here on a special Veterans Day edition of Inside Track. Eb, you had something to add.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that tomorrow we celebrate the 244th Marine Corps birthday. And United States Marine Corps, Department of the Navy, the men's department.
You know, I love this service rivalry thing. So, fellas, I want to deflect a little bit to today and the Veterans Administration and service that the Veterans Administration gives or doesn't give. Your thoughts, Benny, what are your thoughts on this?
Let me add just a little bit more on the Marine Corps birthday. The local Marine Corps League at 216 East 29th is having an event tomorrow to celebrate the birthday. The doors open at 1 o'clock, and then there's a dinner at 5 o'clock. Marines eat free, and their guests eat for $5. And all Marines, whether you're a member of the league or not, are invited to attend that event. It's good to be around other Marines. I've just recently become involved with the VA system and kind of probing how they do things and what they're trying to do. I am convinced that everybody that I have dealt with locally and through the telephone system are really trying to do the best they can to provide good service for the veterans. There's some glitches and some problems with the access, those kind of things. But when I went out to the VA hospital here in Tucson, I had not been to that facility for about 30 years. And I was really impressed with the modern look of the facility. All the equipment and the staff, everybody are really up to date. And I'm very impressed with all of that. There are some issues gaining initial access, but right now the VA has a system called or a study that they're doing called a Million Veterans Program, and what they'd like to do is get as many veterans as they can to fill out a questionnaire online. You just do a Google search for Million Veterans Program, and that'll bring you to the web page. Fill that out, and what they're trying to find out is how are the veterans' health is doing as we age? Do we have any health problems that are different from anybody else, and how can they structure the VA to be able to address those problems? Once you fill that form out, you'll get a notice from the VA system asking you to come out and give them a blood sample so that they can test for other types of ailments that might be occurring. And they'll walk you through that system. And I was very impressed that was a very smooth program. And I'm hopeful that a lot of people will sign up for that. At the time I did that about 2 months ago, they had 700,000 veterans that already signed up. And they're shooting for a million, but I'm sure they won't turn anyone away that comes in for that. A separate part of the program that the veterans are being asked to participate in now is called Agent Orange survey. And anyone that was stationed in country for any length of time, and in country meaning in Vietnam, the Republic of South Vietnam, they're asking to come in and have your health evaluated because there's a lot of illnesses and ailments associated with Agent Orange that they're trying to get their hands around actually what exposure to Agent Orange is causing people to have problems with, and then provide health care for the veterans that are having problems because of that exposure.
So, you know, in addition, obviously, to the enemy, where there's these existential threats to your survival all the time, in the environment that you both served under, there were enormous sorts of environmental risks and exposures and so on that people had, servicemen and women had.
And the more recent veterans from the desert wars have their own set of problems that they've had from just exposure to all of the...
So it's sort of an evolving...
Yeah, you know, all the bacteriological stuff that's out there in the desert sands that gets blown up into the winds, plus the burn pit problem, where they were burning a lot of different kinds of waste, and that smoke and fumes and toxins permeated the places that people were working.
Are you talking about the oil fires that existed as well?
Just normal...
Standard burn pits?
Standard burn pits to get rid of the trash and the debris that accumulates around a military facility. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that stuff is toxic, and it's causing effects on the veterans. And So hopefully our recent veterans are accessing the care facilities at the VA system and getting evaluated for whatever it is that might they might have problems with. Their problem may be based on exposure to that burn pit.
So you had a pretty good experience. Don, experiences of your own?
Very similar. I've had good experiences with the VA, especially the one here in Tucson. It's a well-run facility. And by the way, we put together a book that you know about, the Friday Pilots.
Right.
The sale of every book, we give $5 a book to the Fisher House out at the VA, which is, we're absolutely happy to do that. But in Vietnam, I remember stepping off the airplane. And my first impression stepping off the airplane was, this place smells like war. I mean, the whole country smelled. Some of it was because of the moisture and the swamps and all of that. But some of it was just the smell of war. And the smell of war, for instance, our bases were sprayed all the time to keep diseases and stuff down. Mm. That can't be good for your health, no matter what they sprayed, what have you. And then we escorted these spray planes, the Agent Orange planes that were dropping the Agent Orange to deforest the areas that for the safety of our soldiers and what have you. And basically we escorted them, flew alongside of them, and so we came back smelling like that stuff. The guys that flew the airplanes, of course, they mixed the chemicals, lived in the chemicals from the airplanes. And so all sorts of things are showing up. The question is, you have to look at the data and decide, okay, is this just normal thing that happens to everybody as you get older, or is there really a high incidence of various things? And they found, according to the study, that there are high incidences, and therefore they grant certain levels of disability to people that were involved in Agent Orange, plus the medical tests that Benny referred to.
Hmm. And it does allow you to be enrolled in the healthcare system. There are many tiers of care available through the VA system, but I really encourage anybody that has ever worn a uniform to go check into the VA and get enrolled and have them, let them evaluate your health.
And this is anybody, really, almost anybody who has served. They're probably more apt to have had different exposures that wouldn't be if you were selling insurance someplace or
Absolutely.
Selling used cars, right?
Absolutely.
Now, you Benny, know, how does that work with people that are over 65 and on Medicare?
They're parallel systems. One doesn't conflict with the other. You still have your Medicare. You don't have to drop out of that to have access to the VA healthcare system if you qualify. You can choose one or the other, both. Switch back and forth. There's no restrictions.
And the important thing is both. You don't have to give up your doctors to interact with the VA.
So, you know, in the VA world today, there are literally billions and billions of dollars that have been invested by third-party providers to build these huge VA clinics, you know, medical facilities, not just hospitals, but clinics for service, particularly in areas that wouldn't necessarily be close to a major metropolitan area, that are providing great care.
Right. We have two of those here in Tucson, one in the Northwest and one in the Southeast.
Right.
And they're both great facilities and a great staff. And the way that works is if you need care, you call them up and they recognize who you are and they make an appointment, and just like going to a regular doctor's office.
So you mentioned getting into the system. It sounded as though sometimes it's a little tough to initially access it.
If you have a DD-214, your discharge paper.
Right.
You go to the VA hospital here in Tucson or wherever people might be located. There's an office there that you walk in, you show them your DD-214, they sign you up. That's all there is.
So that's all it is?
Yes.
You walk in with your DD-214 and boom.
That's right.
Where's the one on the northwest side?
It's on Ina, 8300 or so on Ina, out by where the driver's license bureau is. It's right
so near Shannon?
Street. Yeah.
Okay.
Out in that area.
Then the other one's down...
Southeast,
off of
Ajo.
Again, the VA, as Benny said, has taken a lot of guff, and everybody's read about it, you know, blah, blah, incompetence, waste, blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you something. It's just part of the whole medical care system in the United States, which is very confusing, very complex, and we're all trying to figure out how to fix it. But these VA people really care, and they're really trying, and the ones here in Tucson are just dynamite.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Fellas, when you look back at your careers, and I see two bright-looking guys who've had these great careers.
Well, at least one.
No, both of you.
And by the way, I want to make sure that you know that all Marines are my friend.
do you think of yourselves as warriors?
You know, that's a term that Benny and I don't use, and our colleagues don't use, talking to each other. We're not warriors. We did what we wanted to do because it was a wonderful career. It was a wonderful way to live. It was exciting. And we also helped our country. We don't sit around saying we did it because of our country, because of the flag, because of all. Of course we did it because of that. We did it for each other. That's what it was about. When you go to war, you do it for the guy next to you. And you don't have to know him. You'll do anything in the world to save his life because he will do the same thing to save you. That's what it's about. Yeah, it ends up being service and all that, but we don't sit around talking about being warriors. And those of us who have been to war know that it's highly overrided. We like to stay out of it whenever we can unless it's really important to the nation.
Benny, how about you? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, yesterday I went to Home Depot and I was checked out by a young lady at the cashier, and I asked, Home Depot gives you a veterans discount, and I showed her my ID card and got the discount. She said, asked me what service I was in. I told her the Marine Corps and then the Air National Guard, and she said, well, I'm going into the Army next week. She's just graduated from the U of A with a biology degree, and she's on track now to become an Army officer and start her career. And I just told her, that was just fantastic. I said, she's going to enjoy it. I enjoyed every day. I miss it every day. Great people around you all the time. And one of the things that really impressed me, I was a poor kid from Oklahoma, had never been around African Americans or Mexicans or Jews or anything else. And I got thrown in that pot at boot camp, and there were people from all walks of life in there with me. And you lose sense of color and position, status, and everything else. You're all Marines at that point. And your job is to get the job done. And that's all you focus on. And that carried out throughout my military career. We all have our backgrounds, and we all have our bigotries and our biases, but you learn to put all that aside and focus on the mission.
You know, my father-in-law fought in World War II. He was in the Super 6, the 50th Armored Infantry, and was seriously injured outside of Brest, France. And he never wanted to talk about his service. And this is a guy who won, you know, multiple service ribbons and so on. Very brave guy. And he said, you know, Bruce, I never thought about what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor. I never thought about the Nazis in terms of what they had done. I was just struggling to live, to fight, to the next day.
I tell you, Bruce, I've been to Normandy several times, and all you got to do is go to Colvers-sur-Mer, the cemetery, and go out to and look at the beaches from the cemetery there, and you say, I get why they were called the greatest generation. You look at the width of those beaches, understand that they were floating around for 2 or 3 days sick, carrying 100 and 150 pounds on their back, going across those wide, wide beaches under fire, and you say, I get it. I get why they were. But anybody considering the military, just like I feel the same way Benny does, it is a totally worthy way of life. You'll get experiences that no other people will get. You'll get to travel the world and do exciting things. You might not get rich and make the money that other people met, but you will end up being proud of yourself and proud of the people that you served with. Also, for young kids, you can get college benefits and assistance with college. It's really a great way of life and to be considered. I think it's good for everyone. Mm. I wish we had national service with the military only being one way of it.
Yeah, so when we come back, let's talk about that. We've got just a few minutes. Before we go to break, listener who's a veteran says the northwest location is at the southwest corner of Shannon and Ina. I think that's correct.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're a vet and you haven't really participate and you know, getting your benefits and seeing somebody at the Veterans Administration, maybe that's a good place to start if you live up on the northwest side of town. Take a listen. Stay tuned. Don't move. We'll be right back with Don and with Benny and Eb and I, and you're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. We're here with Don Shepherd. We're here with Benny White, Eb Wilkinson. This is Bruce. I'm going to ask my stupid Bruce question. I watched the show about Neil Armstrong, the movie about Neil Armstrong, last summer. And they had part of that thing was him in one of his airplanes, you know, that he flew in the Air Force. And as he was flying, you could hear all these rattles and stuff inside the cockpit. Did those planes rattle a lot?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. And, it must have been something that was captured on that, because you can hear sound in the airplane, but you don't hear rattles and stuff like that. No, you hear the sound of wind and what have you, but Not
Benny?
I think some of the older generations, the props and the cargo category airplanes probably shake and rattle and roll a little bit. But most of the jets are pretty tight.
Pretty tight.
Yeah, if you take your helmet off while you're flying, of course, they're screaming in your ears.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. That was my stupid Bruce question.
If it rattles, I'm bringing it back.
Yeah. Well, remember, it is a low bidder.
Okay. If it rattled, it was probably from the Marine Corps.
No. All right. So, National Service. Don, you had some thoughts on that.
Well, I just think that National Service would be a good thing. Now, they have it, for instance, in Israel because it's a necessity of a small population, a lot of enemies and what have you. But National Service doesn't mean the military. It can mean all sorts of things. In World War, or FDR times, what have you, we can change, you know, the GI Bill for the things that people did. Now, the problem is it's expensive, too, and so it has to fit in the budgets that we have today when we've still got a $23 trillion national debt out there. So we got to figure out how we could do it. But it could be in the military, could be a firefighter, could be a teacher, could be a librarian, could be all sorts of things that I think that National Service would lead to a sense of responsibility for young people if they thought they had to give something back to this country. And that's one of the things these days that's sorely missing is a feeling of our country and having to give to it rather than take from it.
Hmm. Back to the JFK days.
That's not what your country could do for you. That's what you can do for your country.
You need to be involved in something bigger than yourself. Realize that you're a part of the solution to problems. Don't be the problem.
So if you had to do it over again, would you do it again?
In a heartbeat.
I mean, it sounds like it.
Absolutely.
And you talked about the camaraderie, because you're always going to have that camaraderie, right?
Yeah. The only thing I'd do is live longer so I could fly the new airplanes. It's a young man's game now. Benny and I don't belong in those cockpits anymore.
Yeah, I got to be 40 years old as a fighter pilot, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to have to do something else with the rest of my life.
But you did make a transition. You flew commercially.
I did.
And had a successful career doing that.
Right. You know, you ask about what do you do afterwards, and I don't think you ever get over being in the service. It changes your attitude about life and your own capabilities and what you should do, how you should stick to it. I'm going to tell a Don story here for a minute. Don was a squadron commander at the Guard when I was there, and I got assigned because of my naval experience to write a chapter in the book we call the Tactical Manual for the Air Force, and that had to do with war at sea and attacking ships out on the ocean. I went to a couple of Navy schools to find out what they were doing about it, and I spent 2 or 3 months trying to draw diagrams and write paragraphs and pages and get this thing underway. And finally, I just threw my hands in the air and went up to talk to Don. I said, Don, I can't do this. There's just going to be so many people get killed doing this. His answer to me was, how many people are going to get killed if you don't do it?
Yeah, good point. You had an influence over a lot of men and women in your service with the Air National Guard. That was kind of the second part or a part of your career. How many people were under your command?
Well, I think at the high point, I believe it was 119,000. And as we talked about earlier, things change as you move up in rank. When you're a lower-ranking person, you're around people all the time. When you're a squadron commander, when you're a DO, you can look people in the face and you can convince them and you can show them and you can talk to them. And you can show them the way to go and make them do it if you have to. When you get up in the ranks and end up in the Pentagon and places like that, or head of 119,000 people, you have to lead people and convince people halfway around the world that you will never see, feel, or touch. And they have to know what you want, and you are responsible for what they do, and they won't do it unless they believe in it. So you have to learn to lead by message, by theme, by using the long-distance communications and things that we do today. It's a different type of leadership.
What was the toughest deployment that you had? When you look back and say, man, that was hard, and I made it through it.
Well, one of the things, I flew A-4s in Vietnam, and that's just a real simple little one-person airplane that goes out and drops bombs.
Not so simple to a layperson like you, Benny.
Our squadron commander decided that we were going to be the night fighter squadron, and so he assigned us up for flying missions. And our navigation capabilities in that airplane were almost non-existent. We never knew where we were exactly unless we could see the ground and kind of make out. So we went off, taking off at night and trying to find trucks moving down the Ho Chi Minh Trail over in Laos, and it was just a disaster. We dropped flares and tried to find targets and drop bombs. And in the meantime, every gun in Laos was shooting at us, and it was just a bad time. Fortunately, we didn't lose anybody. We did that for about a week, and finally we talked to the squadron commander into joining us on one of those joyrides. He came back and decided we really weren't capable of doing that mission. So that was kind of a tough one.
And Don, you had plenty of experiences yourself.
Yeah, mine were over North Vietnam. I was a MISTI forward air controller flying two-seat F-100s, and our job was to find targets and mark them with smoke rockets for bomb-laden fighters. And our missions were 4 to 6.5 hours with 2 to 3 refuelings. Went back into North Vietnam 3 times on every mission, and it was very, very difficult because to do our job, to see what we needed to see, we had to fly at relatively low altitude, like 4,000, 4,500, and sometimes much lower to find out what we were after. And that's right in the heart of every envelope out there. And so it was really, really tough. We lost a lot of airplanes. And when we came back from the war, we all said the same thing. Never again are we going to go in to fight a war where we don't have the right equipment, the right training, what have you. We were a low-level nuclear air force. We went into conventional war, had to learn to do it again. So it was a very difficult mission, very discouraging, and again, we lost a lot of airplanes unnecessarily because we had no chaff, no flare, no radar warning, no standoff weapons. It was all get down and do it done and dirty, and we lost one airplane after another.
Gentlemen, I'm honored to have you both on the show today, honored to call you friends, and that's also you, Eb, in your peacetime efforts. You guys are very, very special human beings, and thanks for everything that you've done for this country. Until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash and
Eb Wilkinson.
And rooting for an Arizona basketball win against the Fighting Illini tomorrow night. And wishing all of you a very meaningful Veterans Day, a very pleasant good afternoon. And let's think about our veterans this next couple of days, and maybe things will get better in terms of how we work with them in the future. Have a great day.